welcome to Holden Village. In the Creekside Room, Sherry Tan will be speaking about Australia, land of water and fire. So let's listen in on Sherry.
On Tuesday, I talked about Mexico, which is an industrializing country, rapidly industrializing, rapidly changing standard of living. Yesterday, I talked about Central America, which is composed of largely very poor countries. And today, I want to talk about a first world country, Australia. And as I hope to build up to today, to show you where a little bit about where Australia can go in terms of sustainable development in the long run. How many of you have traveled to Australia? You've been everywhere.
We've been there.
You've been to Australia?
I thought you said from there.
Two.
I've been to. Thank you.
Where have you been?
We did pretty well. The east side, we must have gone up 20 times. We went to Sydney and then went down to the very southern tip of the country.
To Melbourne?
I don't even see it on there.
Tasmania?
The very southern, didn't get to the island. Then we flew to Alice Springs and out there's Rock, and up to Keynes and Melbourne. Melbourne and then up there.
Oh, good.
And then up there. The Alice Springs and Ayers Rock and Kings, and then down along the coast. So we just took a loop.
How about you?
We've been to mostly Melbourne and Tasmania. We went to Sydney and to wherever the capital is.
Canberra.
Okay. But mostly the other places.
Anybody else been to Australia? Where have you been? Same place.
Same place.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. What are your impressions? What are your impressions of Australia? Those who haven't been, have not been.
Water and
still
fire.
Put your foot on. Water.
Drought. Actually, I forgot drought. Drought was supposed to be in the middle. It was supposed to be water, drought, and fire. But drought got dropped.
Water, drought, and fire.
Okay.
It's got huge rainforest. It's got everything. When you've got from very cold to very hot, the rainforest, the desert.
We've got rainforest along here. Desert.
Great Barrier Reef.
Koala bears.
Along here, koala bears, down here.
Red earth
all over the place. What else?
Aborigines.
Aboriginal people. Did you play a didgeridoo?
We did.
Sugar cane, yes.
They have America's Cup, don't they?
Well, they don't have it now. Okay. They did. They did. Oh, they have Aussies, absolutely. How many Aussies do they have?
12 million.
17 million. About 17 million. You were right in 1978.
like Canada.
Yeah, right. Very much like Canada in terms of population.
Two-thirds of California. That's all.
Two-thirds of California. No, they don't have that many people.
Yeah, about 17 million.
How many are in California?
About 28, 9.
Oh, okay.
Well, no.
How many of you saw Crocodile Dundee, the movie?
No.
Was that your image of Australia? It's certainly one image of Australia. I've been to all the places that movie was filmed, mainly in the north of Catherine, right up in here.
So walkabout lots of times.
You saw lots of people on walkabout.
Not really. I don't know what you mean by that.
Oh, you didn't see people on walkabout?
Well, they're only in the beginning that you saw.
Oh, you mean in the movie?
In the movie.
Yeah. Actually, you do see lots of people on walkabout around Australia. We had a flat tire right about there. And discovered that we had no jack in our four-wheel drive. And fortunately, we were on a main highway, so we flagged down a couple. And they were in their mid-60s, and he was pretty incredulous, of course, that we didn't have a jack in our vehicle. We were two, but he gets back in his caravan, he had a camper and then a caravan trailer behind it. He gets back in his caravan and puts on a pair of coveralls, gets out a blue plastic tarp, a bucket with wooden blocks in it, his jack, and comes out and starts working on our four-wheel drive, first laying down his tarp and then going to work, putting the jack underneath it while I'm talking to his spouse. I asked her, how long have you been on the road? She said, 6 years. And I said, how many times you been around Australia? She said, 3. And I said, how many times you going around? She said, till we can't do it anymore. And they were kind of a classic case, but one runs into lots of people who have taken early retirement or have taken 2 or 3 years off and are on walkabout around Australia. In the campgrounds over here, we met lots of them who would travel around and maybe leave their vehicle in Darwin and fly south for Christmas. Everybody goes home at Christmas time, but otherwise we're basically on walkabout around the continent. So there are a lot of people on walkabout. It's about 7,600,000 square kilometers. That's about the size of the mainland United States minus Alaska. So about the size of the lower 48. It's a federation, just like Canada, and it's a federation of 6 states and 2 territories. One territory is ACT, which is around the capital of Canberra, and the other territory, of course, is the very large one, Northern Territory. Northern Territory is federally administered, but getting a lot more self-rule today. For instance, it used to be that the state of South Australia managed the schools of Northern Australia. But now Northern Territory manages its own school system. It gets money from the federal government for its school system, but it no longer has to rely on South Australia to manage the schools. Anybody who's been to Australia pay any attention to the currency, to the money, besides spending it? No, it's Australian. It's dollars. They have dollars, and they have 25-cent pieces and fives and tens. I think the currency is fascinating because unlike most countries where there's government officials on the currency or perhaps something very historic on the currency, Australia has famous people on the currency, on the $2 bill, and they do have a $2 bill that's used very widely. They have John MacArthur. He developed the wool industry by breeding fine wool merino sheep that made very fine long wool. On the flip side, they have William Ferrier, who came up with new wheat strains that were drought tolerant. On the $5 bill, they have Joseph Banks, who was a botanist who accompanied James Cook. And there's a whole family of plants in Australia named Banksias, which are very long. They're beautiful plants, but have very long flowers on them with kind of prickly petals that come off of them, and they're called Banksias after John Banks. But I like the $50 bill best, not just because it's a 50, but because it has the Nobel Prize winner Howard Florey on it, who was born in Australia and discovered the clinical value of penicillin. It's not often we put scientists on money anywhere in the world. And Australia put Sir Howard Florey on the 50. On the flip side of the 50 is Sir Alexander Fleming. And Sir Alexander Fleming, of course, was also involved in the initial discovery of penicillin. So on one side we have the guy who commercialized it, and on the other side we have the guy who discovered it. If we take a look at the population of Australia, I'm going to come back to the map a little bit here. If we take a look at the population, the same kind of figure I've had up the last few days. We have Mexico in yellow. You can see the growth in population in Mexico from 1950 to 1990 and projected to 2025. The United States. Australia in red. The figure I had up there yesterday had Central America in red. This is a different figure. But you can see that the population of Australia is not growing at a terribly rapid rate, except that it is indeed doubling from 1950 to the year 2025. Canada is in blue, and you can see that Canada is staying ahead of Australia in terms of population growth. Now,
they're allowing, they were not, didn't used to allow Asians in there, right? Yeah. But I think there's some change or something.
There's been a very major change in Australian immigration policy. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Australia, for a long time, had a very strict limitation on immigration. And the people they were allowing to immigrate were mainly North Americans and Europeans. Right after World War II, there was a large influx of people from Italy, Spain, Yugoslavia, and Greece into Australia. The 1950s had a very large increase in the population of Europeans. Asians were basically banned from immigrating at that point in time. There's been a complete flip-flop since the end of the Vietnam War, and today a fairly large number of Asians are immigrating. There's a lot of money coming in from Hong Kong right now. People who have decided to leave Hong Kong are moving their money to Australia. And part of the reason they can, of course, do it is for the same reason they're moving to Belize, which I mentioned yesterday, because it's a commonwealth. So it's British Commonwealth. So on their Hong Kong passport, they can easily get residency in Australia. But Australia has figured out that it's in the middle of essentially the Far East, and that it's not in the middle of the Atlantic. And therefore, they better make contacts with people in the Far East and be a part of the part of the world they're in. So there are a lot more contacts with Singapore, Malaysia, Indonesia, Thailand, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Japan. In Cairns, you probably saw the 747s coming straight from Tokyo. You see any of those? There are a lot of 747s that come from Tokyo because people like to go play golf at Port Douglas and outside of Cairns, because it's a lot easier to get a tee time in Australia than it is in Japan, and it's almost cheaper to just fly to Australia. if we take a look at population density, needless to say, Australia has the lowest density of any of the countries we have up here, and this is compared to the world population density. Of course, large parts of Australia are not what we would exactly consider to be very habitable, however. Now, what would you expect about urbanization?
Just like you said about Central America, that half the people live in the capital cities.
It's even worse than that. Australia is the most urban of the countries I have up here. Mexico, United States, Canada, and average world urbanization. 80% of all Aussies live in the five largest cities. So in spite of the fact that the average population density is very low, it's a very, very urban country. Since we're going to be talking about Africa a little bit later tonight, I thought I'd put Rwanda on here because Rwanda has the lowest level of urbanization in the world. Rwanda and Burundi, of course Rwanda has even lower, unfortunately, urbanization today, but Rwanda and Burundi are both at 6% urban. India is at 23% urban, and that compares to 80% urban in Australia. Those five largest cities are Perth, which is at about 1.5 million in the metropolitan area around Perth. Melbourne, Sydney, which is the largest, at about 3.5 million in the metropolitan area. Perth, Melbourne, Sydney. Brisbane and Adelaide, where the dot for Adelaide went. Right there. Those are the most populous cities. Of course, we've also got some other large cities. Cairns is now about 100,000, having grown from about 60,000 five or six years ago, and that's largely because of tourism development. Townsville is a pretty large city, Rockhampton. Of course, Canberra, the capital. Hobart, Tasmania. And the important thing, and Fairfax, North City, Darwin, which is at about 60,000. Of those nine cities, you account for almost all of that urbanization. Notice they're all on the coast. There are towns inland, but they're other than Canberra, which is 50 miles inland, well, 90 miles inland. Other than Canberra, all of the cities are very close to water. Actually, I guess this figure shows it nicely. This is population density. And you can see the dense areas of population are the farmable area, the arable area around Perth, and a strip around and up the East Coast. We take a look at average annual population change. Remember we said this was one of the indicators, the possibility of creating sustainable development. Got Mexico, US, Australia, Canada, and the world on here. And you can see Australia in red has an average annual population change here for 1990 to 1995, about 1.5% and about 1.2%. or almost identical to that of Canada, projected for 2000 to 2005. The reason that both Canada and Australia are higher than that of the United States are largely because of immigration, because of a lot easier standards for immigration to those two countries than to the United States, not because of birth rate. I didn't make figures for Canada, for Australia, of mortality, under five mortality, or fertility, because the mortality rate is actually slightly lower than that in the United States for the average Australian. So the kid under five has a slightly better chance of surviving to age five than the average American does. It's different for Aboriginals. Aboriginal people have a much higher mortality rate in Australia, under five mortality rate. But for the population as a whole, mortality rate is very, very low and very, very first world. Likewise, the fertility rate for women, or the number of kids that women have, is down around 1.3, 1.4. Very low fertility rate. And we said that that's a measure of a possibility of a sustainable development. Purchasing power. This is how far the average Aussie's money goes. Notice that the purchasing power of the average Aussie is just a little bit less than the purchasing power of the average Canadian. Here's Australia over here. It's in adjusted dollars, it's about $16,000. The salaries in Australia, most of the jobs in Australia are unionized. There's very little disparity among workers in terms of what they're paid. If you make over $45,000 a year Australian, and the Australian dollar right now is worth about 73.74 cents on the US dollar. If you make over about $45,000 a year, your taxes go up very rapidly. So the average Aussie makes somewhere between about $20,000 and $40,000. Part of the reason tipping is not done in Australia, although it's beginning to come in, but part of the reason tipping is not done is because waitstaff is unionized. Waiters and waitresses are unionized, and they're paid a living wage. They do not need to rely on tips to survive. If we take a look at energy use, and I didn't make a figure of this either, but if we look at energy use, Australia is very close to that of the United States in terms of energy consumption per capita. Aussies like their cars just like we do. And even though they have some mass transit, there tend to be a lot of cars on the road, and they tend to travel very large distances both for holiday and to go to work. To go to work, roads are not as good as in the U.S., so commutes tend to be long and slow if you drive. But it's not at all uncommon for an Aussie who lives in Sydney to decide to drive to Alice Springs for a week's vacation, which would be like us driving to Omaha or to... I think the comparison is just about the same, but I'm not a fan of Alice Springs. No, they drive long distances. They also use a lot of long-distance buses for travel to and from events. The first buses I ever saw with video players in them. We take a look at the arid air, or the distribution of moisture in Australia. This whole area through the center, commonly called the Red Center, is very, very, very arid. There are places where it may not rain for 10 years. Any of you who've seen the Nature of Australia series may have seen the one recently on Lake Eyre, which is right out in here, or Eyre. It fills up every once in a while and has phenomenal bird life, phenomenal pelican life, fish that ball up and live in the mud, or inert in the mud for long periods of time and then come to life, and then the lake completely goes bone dry again. And it'll get water in it once every few years, sometimes as long as 3 to 5 to 8 years between getting water in it. The city of Sydney has a reservoir that holds an 8-year supply of water. They're prepared for Sydney to have drought conditions for 8 years before the reservoir runs out of water. It's in the Great Dividing Range right up above Sydney here. But that's how concerned they are, how concerned Aussies are about access to water. One of the wettest places in the world is in Australia. Just up the valley from Tully, right here, which is about 60 miles south of Cairns, Tully gets about 300 inches of rain a year, and the valley just up there gets even more. It's very wet. Yeah. Oh, you're chasing the clouds.
Yes, right.
You know what this is called? Patrol. You know what this is called?
No.
Australian National Salute. You spend a lot of time chasing flies in Australia, it's true. The little dingleberries you've seen hanging from people's hats, you see people in Australia with that on their hats. Little corks hanging down to keep the flies out of their face. People really do that. And you can understand why after you've been in the flies for a while.
Are they everywhere?
They're everywhere that cattle are. And there's a lot of arid cattle grazing in Australia. We camped at a campground, a beautiful campground. We were the only people there. It was about there. I have never seen flies so bad as in that campground. And it was largely because of the high density of cattle that had been in the area. But yeah, it depends on the season, but there are a lot of flies in Australia. Aussies have figured out a whole bunch of schemes to move water from place to place. Now, this area is non-arid, and very large share is arid. Now, much of this area in between, like right here, and up in some of the semi-arid areas up here, they put together water schemes to move water great distances. The biggest scheme is the Snowy Mountain Scheme, and it exists just south of Canberra. There's a little town called Cooma. If you ever want to see a cute video, they have a 1950s video that they show every day or twice a day at Cooma about building the Snowy Mountain Scheme. And most of what it seems to involve is various royalty from Britain coming to dedicate all the various pieces of this scheme. So it's quite amusing. But at any rate, they actually have a number of reservoirs on this side of the mountains, in the mountains at high elevation, pump the water up through giant tunnels that go 10, 15 miles through the Snowy Mountains, and then let the water run down into reservoirs and have turbines on the the downward side, and then the reservoirs over here have a second set of turbines, and then the water is used to irrigate great areas in the interior. Like I say, this scheme was built in the 50s. There's also the Argyle scheme up here, which is a very major water redistribution system to catch the water in the north during the wet, which basically goes from about October through March, and then utilize that water during the dry, which basically goes from May through about September. These schemes have been successful to varying degrees. The Snowy Mountains scheme created the Murrumbidgee Irrigation Area, and the MIA has been very successful in growing fruits and vegetables to supply to the urban centers around Australia. The downside of it is, because of the fact that the soils out here are, they're very fertile, but have hard pan underneath, the salt has begun to build up, and large parts of the MIA are already suffering salinity problems. So long term, it's not clear what's going to happen there. Likewise, there's been a lot of cotton grown up in this area, and heavy pesticide use, just like we talked about in Central America, is causing pesticide problems in a number of areas through here. The positive side about it is the Aussies have an organization called CSIRO, which is the Government Science and Technology Research Organization, that really is trying to get a handle on dealing with both the salinity and the pesticide problems in these areas. Australians still use some chlorinated pesticides, but have mainly banned all of the same pesticides that we've banned. Aussies tend to put very high stock in research that goes on in the U.S., and we should put very high stock in the research that goes on in Australia, because they do very, very, very good work. Any chemists in the room? Oh, boy. There's an important piece of chemical instrumentation called atomic absorption spectrophotometry, and it was actually invented at Australian University in Canberra. The Argyle water scheme in the north here has not been nearly as successful, and there have been a couple of reasons why. It's very difficult to grow perishable fruits and vegetables in a place that's this remote and get them to anywhere where someone would want them in a timely fashion. If it were cheap enough to haul cantaloupes and 747s, they'd be in good shape, because they have phenomenal melon growing areas. But the difficulty is that it's just not economically feasible to move a lot of the crops that they've tried to grow here to places where, you know, people want them. Also, the population of Australia is such that they're having trouble consuming all of the fruits and vegetables that they can grow in the country. So essentially, there's excess capacity for growing good stuff. We went to a melon farm up here where melons were five for a dollar. And I'm not talking melons like this, I'm talking melons like this. You know, really, really good melons. But so they have come up with irrigation projects to try and move water from the less arid places to the more arid places. Large parts of Australia, however, are dependent on groundwater. If we take a look at the groundwater, unfortunately, the areas that tend to have plenty of rain tend to have no groundwater problems. The interior, this whole area, has groundwater that tends to be saline, tends to have a lot of iron dissolved in it, and may well be alkaline. So large parts of the country, you can't just plop down a well and hope to get drinkable water. It's not because of pollution problems, it's because of the soil types in Australia. So large parts of the country have true problems when it comes to having utilizable water. If you take a look at what people do in Australia with their land, 67% of the land is indeed used for agriculture, but most of that is for arid grazing, meaning that you may have one cow per 100 acres, one cow per 200 acres, and come back and get it every two or three years. That's called mustering. When you gather all the cows back up, that's called mustering. And today, they don't do it with horses. They do it mainly with helicopters and airplanes. So they go out and just buzz the cows until they get them all together somewhere and then can haul them off to be fattened up. As we know in the West here, you don't make a whole heck of a lot of money off of cattle, particularly cattle that have been mainly eating kind of crummy grass. They have to be taken somewhere to either be fattened up on grain or made into corned beef for other kinds of meat products.
Is there a particular type of cattle that is more likely to survive under these conditions?
Yeah, in the north you see lots of Brahmas and Brahma crosses. The Brahmas are very, very hardy to drought and heat. You know, they were originally brought from India and elsewhere in Southeast Asia, and they can really tolerate very low amounts of water and very, very high temperatures. CSIRO has bred various kinds of cattle that have better meat, aren't quite as tough and stringy beasts as our Brahmas. And there's one strain called Murray Grays, which they're gorgeous cattle. They have this kind of dove gray hide to them. And Murray Grays are very popular with anybody who's investing much money in their cattle. There's also a lot of shorthorns grown. So you see Brahmas, shorthorns, and Murray Grays. A lot of Australia could be described as largely unused. Now, that's unused by Western cultures. Much of that land is very definitely used by Aboriginal peoples. Australia has had major Aboriginal reserves set aside, but the most controversial issue going on in Australia right now is land claims. The Aboriginal people have looked at the U.S. tribal land claims in Alaska and the reservations in the lower 48 and are now trying to press for broader use of those lands, those lands that they used prehistorically, European immigration, to actually get ownership of those lands. No treaties, zero treaties were ever signed with the Aboriginals. Their lands were just appropriated. The Australian government set up tribal reserves around the country, and in some places they're pretty large, but those tribal reserves have been largely administered by the European government, not by Aboriginal peoples. They're trying to get the ability to administer their own lands, and they're also trying to broaden their land claims. There was a suit that went to the Supreme Court of Australia and was decided in favor of the Aboriginal peoples based on a little island which is off the north coast here. There's an island called Thursday Island up here, and a guy on Thursday Island met an attorney who was up there one time, a barrister, and they discussed his family's occupation of that territory, of that island, for the last 1,000 years, and the barrister took it all the way to the Australian Supreme Court and won. And by winning that, it's given the Aboriginal peoples a real optimism about managing to get major land claim settlements, and it has European Aussies pretty distressed right now about what might happen. But at any rate, much of this unused land, quote unused land, is land that Aboriginal peoples are claiming. Bush food has gotten really popular in Australia. Have you got any bush restaurants? Well, there are two kinds of bush food. There's European bush tucker, and that includes stuff like bread that you wrap around a stick like you did when you were in Girl Scouts and cook over the fire, and Billy tea where you throw a handful of tea in a pot of boiling water and drink it. It tastes real strong and awful. And, you know, stuff like that. But then there's also Aboriginal Bush Tucker, and it's gotten very popular, very chic now in places like Sydney and Melbourne, to have restaurants that use things like wattle seeds, which is a native kind of seed that's very high in protein to make torts and all kinds of, you know, spiffy breads and stuff like that. Kangaroo has gotten popular in the restaurants because it's very low fat, very low cholesterol. Emu meat, it's a very lean, dense bird meat, and emus are being grown commercially today. It used to be that kangaroo meat was only used for pet food. And in two states, it was actually dyed blue, so it couldn't be illegally sold in grocery stores. I have a friend who takes people on Bush Tucker outings where, you know, they eat local food, eat snakes and stuff, and widgety grubs and other stuff like that. You ate a widgety grub?
Yeah. If I were hungry enough.
It was like a quarter of an inch large. You could say you had.
You could say you
had.
Fortunately, the last time I was, when we were at a Bush Tucker restaurant, widgety grubs were out of season and made my head. Anyway, he'd take people on these Bush Tucker hikes, and the way they got their snakes was they used roadkills. because it was illegal to take the snakes they were taking. They didn't tell their customers they were using roadkills. But when they serve kangaroo, which he considers to be very good, they just go down and buy some at the local kangaroo slaughterhouse, but it was all dyed blue. So they'd make sure that they ate real late that night so it was dark. But at any rate, Aboriginal peoples are starting to grow more Bush Tucker and are able to sell it commercially because it has become very popular, and it actually probably is sustainable for some of the Aboriginal peoples who are living in areas that are mainly considered to be desert to be able to do that kind of thing. Notice that the urban areas only take up 0.1% of the land area but have 80% of the people. Sydney proper is very small, just like London proper is very small. The suburbs, you know, it's like a square mile is the actual area that is Sydney proper. Right here on Port Jackson, actually right about there. But the Sydney area is governed by a metropolitan government that covers lots and lots of suburbs in a fairly large area. How many of you have heard about the forest fires in Sydney about a year and a half ago? They ravaged the area, absolutely ravaged it. This area right up here is called the Hawkesbury River. It has a phenomenal national park that was very, very wild. Lots of birds, gorgeous place. You could actually take public transportation all the way to up about here and then rent a boat, a canoe or whatever, and muck around in the Hawkesbury River. Unfortunately, a very large share of this area was decimated by the forest fires, and they actually burned down to the coast in a number of places. Back up in here are the Blue Mountains. When you get out to these suburbs out here, you're actually beginning to get into the Blue Mountains. The Blue Mountains are named because of the blue haze that comes from the eucalyptus trees. The reason for their fires was very similar to some of the reasons for our forest fires here. A very dense load of materials under the trees. Very high fire burden. And once those fires got rolling, with the drought that Sydney had at that time, even with all the fire trucks they could muster from all over Australia, literally they came from all over, they couldn't stop those fires once they got burning in the eucalyptus. And they really did burn through a number of subdivisions. Aussies are very, very, very fire conscious, and as I already mentioned, drought conscious, because there have been horrendous fires in Australia over the last 100 years. and it almost always has to do with letting a fire burden build up. What started happening now in the north is really quite astounding to me. To go back to this map of the whole country, right up here is a park called Kakadu National Park. And it is indeed where a fair amount of Crocodile Dundee, the movie, was filmed. About 30 to 40 miles inland is a cliff called the Escarpment. It's about a 1,000-foot high cliff, and from there it's just kind of coastal plain out to the ocean. With the past fire burden, if a fire started at the Escarpment, it would burn 30 to 40 miles to the ocean. Wouldn't stop. They could do nothing to stop it once it got rolling. Today they burn 20% of the park every year in controlled burns. And so every 5 years they've burned off the entire park, and they're keeping the fire burden down in that way. Now the eucalyptus trees up here are a little bit different than the eucalyptus trees down here in the wetter areas. The eucalyptus trees in the north seem to be very fire hardy and seem to have a very low amount of oil, eucalyptus oil, in their bark and in their leaves. So the fire can burn right under them and the trees don't catch fire as long as the fire burden is low and there isn't a buildup of eucalyptus trees that leaves underneath. The way they start the fires is they do it either right at the end of the wet season or right at the beginning of the next wet season. So they don't burn during the very driest part of the year. Aboriginals, by the way, have in the north described the year as seven seasons. The wet, the end of the wet, the beginning of the dry, the end of the dry, the beginning of the wet, and the wet. So the entire cycle is described in terms of wet and dry. There's a very complex both mythology and language structure involving wet and dry. But anyway, they burn this area, these areas off by literally three different ways. Throwing matches out of airplanes and helicopters. Throwing matches out of youths, which are like pickups. Or using little flamethrowers. So they really do go along and light the fires, and they light them in controlled areas, watch the area burn, make sure that it doesn't get near any building or other structure that should be protected, and then just cycle through the park from area to area. They're doing this very widely in the north. It's much more controversial, of course, when you start to talk about doing something like that in your major urban areas. So just like us, they're working very hard right now to try and figure out how to deal with the huge fire burden that they have that's built up in the south. Two more things and I'll shut up. Australia in its urban areas has many of the same problems we have in our urban areas. Australia is about as far along on wastewater treatment as is Canada, meaning they got problems. About 10, 15, 20 years ago, depending on the exact area, Aussies recognized that they had sewage blowing up on their beaches. The beaches, which of course Aussies love their beaches, the beaches along the coast here around Sydney were actually getting balls of fat coming up on the beaches. Those balls of fat have bacteria and viruses, etc., associated with raw sewage, literally. So they extended their pipes. They extended the outfall pipes anywhere from half a mile to a mile out. All that did was make the sewage flow up farther up the beaches, but slightly more dilute. The wastewater treatment plants in these dots shown here in blue, this is North Point, just north of Sydney. The town of Manly, which is a real neat little town, is right here. And the beach right around Manly is regularly contaminated from the sewage blowing up on the beaches. Down here at Malabar, and from Malabar south, there's a stretch along here that's completely closed from people going to the beach. The beaches are restricted because of the sewage blowing up on the beaches. They're trying right now to figure out how to fund improving the wastewater treatment plants. This one right here at Malabar is probably going to be the first one to be upgraded because it causes the biggest impact, really serious deleterious impact on beaches. Likewise, when you look at Botany Bay, which is down here, which of course Captain Cook, by the way, landed on this side of Botany Bay, and a week later, Perot, a Frenchman, landed on this side of Botany Bay. He was so unhappy to find out that Captain Cook had landed here that he ultimately committed suicide about it all. I think arriving a week late in Australia isn't a reason to commit suicide, but he did. Botany Bay is the area with heavy industrialization around it, and the bottom sediments are contaminated in Botany Bay, just like the bottom sediments are contaminated in Boston Harbor and many of the other estuaries around the United States. The Australian government is trying very hard to regulate the industries that surround Botany Bay. Regulation, however, is a little bit complicated because, remember I said this was a federation, so each state makes its own laws in terms of pollution control. The federal government can make make recommendations, but the states actually make the laws. New South Wales and Victoria have the strictest laws. West Australia and Queensland have the loosest laws. Queensland is commonly called the Alabama of Australia. Both in terms of social services and laws, you know, involving the environment and other issues. Now, what does Australia have going for it? Metals. Minerals. This is the list, minus mercury. Mercury and one other one. This is a list of metals that are considered among the most strategic metals in the world. And this shows where Australia ranks in terms of production of those metals. They're number one in terms of production of aluminum. Now, this is not actually making aluminum cans. This is making aluminum oxide concentrate that's then shipped to places like Tacoma, Washington, and Spokane, and other aluminum smelters to be turned into aluminum metal. But they make aluminum oxide concentrate, and they ship abroad 23 million metric tons annually. They're number six in cadmium, 10 in copper, number one in lead, five in nickel, nine in tin, two in zinc, and three in iron ore. They also have started shipping large quantities of diamonds, with the South African diamond cartel kind of beginning to unravel a little bit. Australia has huge diamond resources in West Australia. They also produce manganese, cobalt, tungsten, vanadium, gold, various other gemstones such as rubies, emeralds, and opals. The US government, in its estimate of the dollar value of the reserves in Australia, the mineral reserves in Australia, estimates that Australia has 386 million dollars in mineral reserves. Okay, so that's like $386 billion in mineral reserves in Australia. They got a lot of reserves. At present, at the production levels they're producing right now, many of these are not likely to run out, or none of these are likely to run out in the foreseeable future. So they have vast mineral wealth, some of which is only now being tapped. So where does Australia stand in terms of sustainability? We've got relatively low population, vast natural resources, relatively high standard of living, relatively low birth rate, low under five mortality. What do you think? Pretty good. Australia is actually one of the countries in the world that could probably put together a program of sustainable development more easily than anywhere else. You know, that it has the natural resources, it has the highly educated population base, And, you know, good standard of living that makes it probably, if not the best, almost the best place in the world for putting together a sustainable development program. Have they worked on it? Not really. Reason why is largely political. Because of the federation structure, it's been very hard for the states to work with each other on those kinds of you know, long-term planning activities.
Yes. Don't they have a very soon, I understand, they're going to cut the cord with Britain and become no longer a commonwealth. So maybe they'll get more inclined to be a unit rather than a kind of a piggyback.
Yeah, it's very likely that they'll cut the cord with the commonwealth.
Aren't they about, weren't they going to vote about 2000?
Yeah.
Oh, they, it's the big thing about the Olympic Games. They don't want to do it before the Olympic Games or something.
And the Commonwealth Games. That's, get this, one of the best reasons to stay in the Commonwealth is to go to the Commonwealth Games. Aussies play seven kinds of football, you know, I mean, Commonwealth sports are very important. But you're right, they're talking about a vote in the year 2000 on whether or not to stay in the Commonwealth.
I have one more comment that was interesting to me when we were in Melbourne, is you were talking about your sewage disposal. It was Melbourne City sewer system. They poured it out on the top of a kind of a swampy area and put other stuff on it. Planted it in grass, put cows on it, threw it down on a lower place, put a little bit of stuff on it. I don't know about that.
But very effective and very efficient.
They've been doing it for years and years, and it's a beautiful pasture-looking area, and it's very close to...
Actually, the CSIRO has done some very good research on biofiltration and wastewater treatment. And the Melbourne system doesn't seem to be working quite as well as it should be, but CSIRO thinks they know how to fix it, so it will work. But it's a very interesting, relatively low-cost way to handle your sewage. Sydney can't do the same thing because it's so urban and so up against the water.
So they dump it out in the ocean.
Yeah. The other thing they do, which is really disgusting, is they filter out the sludge during the day, they let the stuff settle, and then at night they dump the sludge. It's really dumb.
I would suppose that, looking at the map, when the present generation, more or less, elder generation, kind of goes, and with it the great traditions that you and I, everybody else here, were born with, saw and raised and so forth, there will be a real lock on to Asia. This will be regarded as, it probably already is, as a, if not a colony, kind of. Well, we are economically, we become largely an economic colony of the Orient, but far more so, many times more so.
There's a huge, you're right in terms of investment, there's a huge amount of Japanese money pouring into Australia. Most of the hotels in the Cairns area, all the new hotels, 1984 when I was in Cairns, there were like two high-rise resort hotels. Now I couldn't even count them. There's so many. There's a shopping center on the water. Aussies, you know, I like to say that you could lie down in the middle of the street, Main Street, Saturday at noon when the shops close, and you wouldn't be run over until Monday morning at 9. But, I mean, literally, Aussies shut things down. Cairns, we were in the shopping center at 8 o'clock on Sunday morning, and it was full of people. It's a total change in mindset. And it's largely because of American tourists, Japanese tourists, and all the money that's coming into the country. But I agree, there's going to be a big change. Right now, Aussies, the older generation of Aussies, are extremely pro-American because they feel that the U.S. saved their hides in World War II. They're Young men had been drafted and sent to Europe, and Australia was largely left defenseless in 1942 as the Japanese were moving south across Papua New Guinea. And it's really fascinating how much of Northern Australia was bombed in World War II. Cairns, the number has been restricted until fairly recently, but there were thousands, there were a couple thousand people killed in bombing runs in Cairns before people were largely evacuated.
Darwin.
But there was bombing. Darwin was seriously bombed, Catherine was bombed, Broome was actually bombed, Cairns was bombed. This area was not affected so seriously, but this whole area was largely evacuated. It is covered with American Air Force bases that were built during World War II. Covered. So there's a very pro-American feeling in the older generation because of World War II.
Well, it was the Oregon National Guard that went over the Owen Stanley Mountain in New Guinea.
Yeah.
And they know that.
Yeah, they do. Absolutely. We had an Aussie bus driver who was just about retirement age, who had been 17 during the end of World War II, and he wanted to show us every airfield in Northern Australia. My PLU students, that was on a trip with PLU students, they weren't really into seeing every airfield in Northern Australia. They wanted to see every beach, but not every airfield. Yeah.
Let's see, your statement on Australia being able to sustain the population, you're ranking them high. How would Canada compare to that?
Canada would be very, very similar.
Yeah, that's what I guess. Mm-hmm. I mean, all the other statistics that were almost parallel.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. I think I would prefer to be in Canada, though I'm not sure.
No. I don't know, those beaches.
Okay, I'm not a beach person.
The only thing to remember is that Australia is very close to Antarctica in relative terms, and there is ozone depletion in Australia, and Aussies are very, very sensitive to the increased rate of skin cancer. Australia is the only really tropical country in the world that is essentially totally populated by light-skinned Anglos, and it has the highest skin cancer rate in the world by far. And it's real interesting to see what's happened over the last 10 years, because people have gone from wanting to be, you know, tanned absolutely black to a major government campaign, national campaign, to use sunscreen. And there's a lot of concern on the part of Aussies now about the possibility of cancer from sunscreen. And so they're working very hard to cover up. They said it's hard to cover up when you're in a very hot tropical country with very intense sun. But it's a major issue. It's really funny. While we were in Australia, there was a special on skin cancer on, and they showed the difference in the way they show sunscreen commercials in France or Britain, with people being quite dark when they're showing putting on sunscreen, to Australia, where they show people being very light when they're putting on sunscreen.
The sewage on the beach is going to keep the people off the beach. It's going to have a beneficial effect.
All it did was make them real mad. It made people, when they began to hear about the sewage on the beaches in Sydney, it turned more people into environmentalists overnight than anything you can fathom. I mean, tampering with their beaches, telling them somebody was screwing up their beaches, really made them mad.
Actually, that's better than the situation with our Victoria.
Yeah.
It's Australians against Australians, whereas Canadians doesn't sound like they get to those.
Yeah. Other comments? Yes.
Are there mainstream environmental organizations there?
Very definitely. Audubon Society is relatively strong in Australia. Australian Conservation League, Wilderness Society is very strong in Australia. They have major campaigns. I didn't get into forestry issues at all, but they're really interesting forestry issues along the coast.